Hello. Okay, I guess we'll begin there. Put this someplace. Welcome, everyone. I have handouts for folks who have not gotten this.
You got one.
Okay.
Have one.
Thank you. You're welcome. Feel free to sit close since there are so many of us. Hi, radio policy? You're just randomly walking around?
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess that's what people do at Occupy Chicago. They just randomly walk around to various things. What?
Among other things.
Okay. Okay. Let me read what I had submitted as the summary of this presentation. Radio personality Rush Limbaugh has drawn much flack in recent months for his comments, which has drawn controversy, protests, and advertiser pullback. By coincidence, all Illinois radio stations will face license renewals by the end of 2012, opening a window which allows activists with a rare opportunity that can be utilized to improve radio and the media. This workshop reviews radio policy in terms useful for political activists, including the context of the history of media activism in America going back to the 1840s, a capsule history of radio and the Federal Communications Commission, and to the strategy and particulars of using the 2012 Illinois radio license renewal window. So, I was planning on dividing this presentation. I'm planning to talk for about 35 minutes, more or less, with more or less dividing this up into, you could call it five sections. There are two, we'll call it five sections. One is the history of media reform. People think that media are, in a lot of ways, just happen, or that the way they're shaped more or less falls from the sky. Far from it. There are very often very long, bitter, contentious fights that happen almost entirely without public knowledge. Very little of, even a lot of activists know almost nothing about the struggles over media that happen and have happened in recent years, and I think to their ultimate detriment. Had activists gotten involved in fights, I think the media system and media today in the United States and perhaps more worldwide would be very different. So it's worth reviewing that to remember that. In particular, we'll focus, and this is the second section, on the history of radio, in particular with regards to the history of radio policy in its formation, setting the stage for what would follow mostly in the 1920s and 1930s. And this is very relevant because for two reasons. One, it proved to be the high watermark of media activism in the United States. Never before and arguably never since has there been that many people involved in questions on where the media would go, and radio in this particular, to the extent that had been in radio in the 1920s and 30s. So it's worth reviewing that, and with regards to the government agencies that were helped to task along those lines, the Federal Radio Commission and its success agency, which is still around, the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. Third, in particular, we'll talk about in regards to Illinois and here and now. In 2012, all radio stations in the United States are going to have their licenses renewed by law. Illinois happens to have their radio stations up for renewal this year, and that accords some opportunities and abilities that can make an influence on where our media go later on, and we'll talk about that. And then long-term trajectories as far as where we would go next from what's going on now. And then a longer-term issues for perhaps the next coming decades. It's worth to not only know the history of this going back to at least 170 years, but also to know where this is going forward, because the actions we take now help to shape where that goes in the future. So that's basically the presentation I've got and planned here. It's 12:05 now, and we'll probably talk for a little under 30 minutes. And there's a lot here. I am recording this, so if anyone wants to review this later or hear this later, let me know after class and I can share this. Also, if anyone has any questions, let me know. Although I would advise, unless there is a specific point of clarification within the presentation, wait till the end. Okay, so history of media reform. I like starting with the Stamp Act in presentations like this, because that was actually one of the galvanizing points of the American Revolution, and for good reason. It basically put a serious restriction on freedom of speech in the American colonies before the Revolution in the United States, to the extent that it actually imposed, where people complain about maybe an 8% tax or a 10% tax, the Stamp Act was a 50% tax on all printed materials. Everything from playing cards to pamphlets to printed books. You had to not only pay whatever the price was, but also an additional 50% tax that was imposed by King George III of England. And that, that in addition to a lot of other drumbeat factors, but that was a very critical one, was a bit, were led to the American Revolution, basically. And having suffered through that onerous experience with regards to the Stamp Act, the founders of the American Republic were kind of sensitive to where the media would go from here. And so they set up a number of factors with regards to this. One would be that, obviously, they wrote within the Constitution matters such as the First Amendment, the matters regarding freedom of speech and expression, as well as matters related to policy of the first national media network in the United States, which is still around, and which actually was critical for fomenting a robust public dialogue over the course of 70 years. I'm talking about the post office. It was critical because most of media that was distributed for the first 70 years of the United States were in the form of newspapers. And most of those were sent in via the post office. And that was absolutely critical as far as generating a robust public dialogue, and was very critical for establishing the beginnings of a democratic discourse. It was well understood then, and increasingly so more these days, that in order to have a functioning democratic society, you need to have a robust, open, and responsive and responsible media. And so the post office was set up as a response to that, and helped to, it was subsidized in an effort to try to keep costs low. There were actually serious considerations to actually have all things free. Hold up on just one moment. There were actually serious proposals that were played to actually make all post office traffic free for all participants, because they knew that money was sometimes an onerous influence as far as media went. And so that was why that was set up, and why the post office actually was the a very critical component as far as media systems, even though people today might not think of it as such. Yes, sir?
What is the post office
in
doing this?
It's critical. It's part of the whole context of the entirety of media in the United States, which I'll explain if you hear me out in a bit. Hear me out. I mean, it might not seem like it's critical, but it was critical because it was actually nationalized and put under reasonably democratic responsiveness. Low cost, wide reach, and was responsible for fomenting a democratic discourse over the course of 70 years. And what would happen, starting in about 1840, is a turnaround away from that. And you can actually start with the major successor media to that, the telegraph, which, unlike the post office, which was nationalized and put under widespread discourse and low cost, the telegraph was put under a fiefdom of private control, which wound up basically turning into a market of roughly about 50 companies, which in fairly short order wound up consolidating with a single company, a company that's actually still around and which you may have used as the fastest way to send money, Western Union. For the better part of about 50 years, it was the telegraph monopoly in the United States. And that mattered because then it was, because it's of its monopoly status and its private status, it could raise costs and make reduce the ability for people to communicate. In fact, there were two main concerns about its abuse with regards to the use of using the telegraph in order to jimmy stock prices, as well as its abuse by what was then the national media monopoly, or newspaper monopoly, in the United States, which is still around, the Associated Press. It was actually formed in the 1860s as a way to buy shared time across newspapers for the purchase of telegraph time. And what wound up happening was they actually wound up being very successful at it and using that to basically cut a deal to become the monopoly newspaper provider for providing newspaper content for newspapers around the country. And as a result, actually wound up becoming what was referred to as an infernal bondage, a telegraph monopoly on the one hand, as well as a newspaper monopoly with Western Union and with the Associated Press. And there were calls to try to reform the telegraph industry. In fact, upwards of 70 proposals over the course of the 19th century, which Western Union lobbyists all defeated over the course of 50 years, roughly from about 1860 to roughly 1910. People complain now regarding trying to, you know, enact media policies or fights regarding media. This is nothing new. It's been going back, way back. And you can talk about this with regards to telegraph reform and calls to try to nationalize the telegraph, which newspapers, understandably so, because they were embedded to this, gave barely short shrift to this effort and did not campaign on it at all, dismissed any efforts regarding it, barely giving it any coverage, hardly at all. But they were there. The efforts were there, and unfortunately they failed because of this monopoly status. What wound up breaking that monopoly, at least in the immediate term, actually was a mistake that Western Union had made with regards to its purchase and the development of a successor technology that was established by a professor of phonetics at Boston University named Alexander Graham Bell, who wanted to create what he called the harmonic telegraph, the idea of using different harmonics, different frequencies of a single telegraph wire in order to transmit multiple telegraph signals. The thing about this advance in technology is you could also carry the same signals for the human voice. And so it actually was, you might have heard of this technology, a telephone. And that's how that started. Alexander Graham Bell's father-in-law, Gardner Green Hubbard, was pretty savvy with regards to money and business, and wound up making a company using the monopoly patent he was able to win, which was that was actually a struggle too. And with that patent was able to create a company as a result of a number of corporate intervening mergers, the American Telephone and Telegraph Company, AT&T, which wound up having a monopoly control mainly through control of the patent of the telephone. And that wound up being basically the successor media in the United States. The telegraph then, well, the telephone actually had its patent expire in 1894. And as a result of that, we actually had and saw across the United States a number of independent telephone providers that would actually try to establish a more responsive presence and innovation potential for the telephone across the United States. And they were actually very successful at it. And in their peak, maybe around like 1910 or so, they actually held up with 40% of the telephone market in the United States. And that's when AT&T, which had held the monopoly market, had held the monopoly patent, and wanted to corner the market, realized they were probably going to be outgunned unless they acted fast. And so that's actually what they did. They wound up going on a major PR and technical offensive campaign, utilizing weaknesses within some of the technical infrastructure of the independents, buying some outright, utilizing a branding of universal service. Over the course of the subsequent three decades, wound up succeeding. They actually wound up capturing more than 80% of the market in the next three decades. And as a result, the potential of having the telephone be a more responsive technology ultimately wound up failing. Movies were actually the next successor technology and the result of that. And from 1900 to 1920, you actually saw a very wide, the costs of entry for movies were actually very low. And you actually saw what were termed Nickelodeons, small theaters that would present a variety of films. A lot of them were popular films, some melodramas, some newsreels, but you also saw a lot with a very radical character that were regarding a lot of the social issues of the day, women's suffrage, political radicalism, political protest, critique of the war, and that was actually part of the scene. And it, the costs were so low with regards to movies that a lot of people could enter the fray and make that a viable entry. What wound up changing were a couple of things on that front from that kind of responsiveness into a kind of more monopoly structure. One was that you had a single guy, an immigrant from, I think he was from Bulgaria, Adolf Zukor, who wound up actually establishing the first of the major studio system companies, Paramount.
Excuse me, his name again.
Zukor, Adolf Zukor, Z-U-K-O-R. And he actually wound up controlling, well, taking a lot of the different components for making a film, both the production of the film stock, the distribution of it, as well as even owning the theaters. And he established, by buying up pieces of this and a lot of shrewd corporate maneuvers, the first major, wide-ranging, vertically integrated corporate news outlet. Which was called Paramount. That wound up triggering a wave of consolidation that you wound up seeing across the board with a number of other media outlets. Warner Brothers, Fox, RKO, Lowe's, which owned MGM, Universal. It wound up being about roughly eight companies that wound up then resulting in the intervening corporate mergers that resulted as a result, that came out of as a result of this. There were efforts to try to break this too, including one, actually, a proposal from a single a union electrician by the name of Patrick Murphy, which wanted to actually take the newspaper, actually wanted to take all the union halls in the United States, maybe 1,500 in number, and turn them into a series of movie theaters. And if they had done that, it would have actually turned that almost instantly into the largest movie chain in America, and union run, and would have provided an audience for a rival movie industry to what the studio system was providing in its consolidation and squelching of a lot of dissident ideas. Unfortunately, that failed mainly because, at least for what historians were able to glean out of this, there was not a whole lot in the way of responsiveness from unions at the time, unfortunately. They considered it secondary to real work, even though they didn't. A lot of people, unfortunately, didn't understand the potential that such media had and would play, especially as media owned and controlled by major corporations would actually be used as a bludgeon against a lot of popular efforts to great success. So, as you can see through going through roughly about 1920, from medium after medium, from the print medium through the telegraph, through the telephone, through movies. You had a kind of widespread pattern of it being reasonably open, and with one exception at the outset, a consolidation basically through market means that then wound up squelching whatever that previous wide open opportunity had been. This kind of is the pattern where radio comes into play. But here it's kind of unique because the government played a really particular role, less so markets, although markets also and corporations played a definite role in this. But it also is particularly notable in that it was probably the high watermark of political activism on media issues in American history. From roughly 1928 until about 1935, you had a lot of activist groups, everyone from educators to civil libertarians to religious groups to political activists to labor unions were involved in more or less loose coalitions, but very active in trying to help to shape the trajectory regarding radio in the United States. And this is where the Rush Limbaugh thing comes into play, but you know, getting a little bit ahead of ourselves in the game here. The early history of radio, kind of like all these other media, was the kind of widespread use, hundreds of nonprofits, lots of local broadcasters, a lot of university broadcasters. And this was the lion's share of media, maybe upwards of 85% of all the radio stations were this kind of locally owned, locally responsive, widespread matter. licenses were at the time handed out by the Department of Commerce, which was headed at the time, ironically enough, by a guy, Herbert Hoover, who actually wound up becoming president of the United States later on. But in 1926, a court order actually overturned all of those licenses because the Department of Commerce did not have congressional authority to broadcast those licensed radios, those radio stations. So what wound up happening was Congress hurriedly passed a law that actually, the Radio Act of 1927, which basically set up an authority, the Federal Radio Commission, to hand out the allotment of these licenses. And that Federal Radio Commission, because a lot of radio manufacturers and broadcasters of a corporate orientation, wound up basically stacking the deck at the FRC and shaping the policy for where radio would go in the late 1920s. What wound up happening there was one critical order, what was called General Order 40, which basically took the most popular signals and the biggest broadcast stations and spectra and basically reallotted it to major corporate broadcasters. At the time, NBC and CBS, who at the time were kind of small marginal players, but because of this policy shift became very big, very fast, and wound up, and also in alliance with their broadcast lobby, the National Association of Broadcasters. Hi, radio?
No.
Other room. Hi. Yep. It was in this reallotment where that fight, where that coalition I had mentioned earlier kind of coalesced and fought to fight back regarding radio. And they fought back pretty hard, but they were unfortunately outgunned, both because a lot of their spectrum that they had used was lost to them. They were certainly outspent. They certainly didn't have the money that the opposition had. And also the prestige that the other side had quickly allotted for themselves. That with a number of other key maneuvers, including winning the key support of the newspaper industry at the time, in order to try to form a truce to prevent newspapers from being a rival to the corporate radio stations. What the result of all of this was basically the establishment of a successor agency to the Federal Radio Commission called the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, in 1934, as well as the establishment of the Communications Act of 1934, which basically solidified that those new players, the new corporate players, into their received positions, and basically locking that in practically in perpetuity. But that serious fight there was, the players that were involved in that fight unfortunately had unraveled in the wake of that. But struggles to try to improve things despite that loss and try to chip away at that win did continue. You had, for example, the establishment of nonprofit FM radio, which would help to establish the Pacifica Radio Network, which broadcasts Democracy Now! And actually dates back to 1948, when a pacifist broadcaster, Lou Hill, actually wound up winning a number of early FM radio licenses, back in the time when FM was still a new and marginal technology. Radio was kind of de-emphasized in the wake of television, in the wake of this, but still was something of a big technology that came through this. You had also the establishment of what was referred to as public policies on responsibilities of broadcasters who actually did hold those licenses. Two in particular, one was referred to as the Blue Book, which was basically the outline of corporate media, public service responsibilities that corporate media stations were supposed to have. One of those was what was referred to as the Fairness Doctrine, which basically said that broadcasters had to put in a good faith effort to try to break up the tedium of different perspectives on their radio stations. And that wound up holding and helping to at least provide at least some modicum of public service up until roughly the 1980s, when in the wake of a kind of what's termed a neoliberal assault with both Reagan in the United States and Thatcher in Britain, were trying to tear away at a lot of more responsive public institutions in the United States and elsewhere. Media was part of this assault. The guy who actually carried that out on behalf of the FCC was a gentleman who was served as the chair of the FCC for 6 years in the 1980s named Mark Fowler, who in 1984 basically said that he would not enforce the Fairness Doctrine anymore, and in fact just deemed television in an infamous regard a toaster with pictures. It's just another appliance, and it doesn't hold any more special position in people's lives than just being another machine that people use, which was rather dismissive. But nonetheless, it wound up playing a very critical role, especially in the court orders to try to overturn the FCC's response on that front, which failed. That then opened the door for a broadcaster out of Kansas City who had previously worked as a baseball announcer, but who decided to go into politics and political broadcasting using this new change of policy from the FCC, a gentleman named Rush Limbaugh, who wound up in 1989 starting his own locally syndicated radio program, which wound up then going national, and which wound up proving to, because he would have a lot of time and with a lot of influence, and with lots of people still using radio as a means of communication, it wouldn't hold the kind of influence that television had, but it was still there and it's still influential. That place was where that then set the groundwork for a kind of right-wing talk radio blogosphere, or a talk radio sphere, not blogosphere, sphere, where people then, where right-wing politicos, particularly of the Republican Party, were able to use that as a support and as a kind of almost free political advertising through this. And as a result of his success in this front, you found a lot of people who were kind of aping his success and trying to establish their own kind of presence on radio radio networks, to the point where now surveys have done upwards of 80 to 90% of talk radio in the United States is of a kind of right-wing character. But it didn't just happen because of just Rush Limbaugh emerging out of nowhere. It happened because of all of these various policies and the fights regarding media going back all the way back to this point. So that's, and with Rush Limbaugh especially having shot his foot in his mouth for quite a long time, he routinely will say things that had drawn ire and controversy, sometimes a little bit of controversial blowback. What might have been the biggest controversy to date was one that occurred actually just within the last couple of months with regards to a young woman named Sandra Fluke, who had testified only before a Democratic committee on birth control matters, but who he had deemed a slut and a prostitute, and as a result of that, basically wound up generating a lot of flack, controversy, protests, and advertiser pullback. Question?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could touch up a little bit on what happened in the 90s, like AT&T and their monopoly, and how it broke down, how they broke them down.
Right.
I just wasn't sure if it was all rumors or if it was all...
There was... Thank you for mentioning that, because that actually plays a little bit into the internet, not a whole big topic, but kind of similar pattern of what we've been seeing here regarding media. In AT&T, since their win in the 1940s, had basically been the telephone monopoly in the United States. And there have been efforts starting in the 1970s to try to break that up, saying they were it violated antitrust laws that were in the United States. They succeeded in 1983. When an antitrust suit finally did break up that monopoly into what wound up being like a bunch of companies, 8 small baby bells, as they're called, as well as 23 other holding companies across the United States. And that helped as far as allowing new players to foment innovation and reducing that barrier to entry, as economists call it, to be able to enter into having a more responsive telephone or telephony system. What wound up happening, though, was kind of like markets are wont to do, and as we've seen with regards to the telegraph and movies and in media after media and in industry after industry, this is an old pattern, markets tend to consolidate, and that's what wound up happening. In the course of the intervening 2 decades, what wound up starting of roughly 30 companies consolidated roughly into just 3 the new AT&T, which had been SBC, the smallest of the baby bells, which went on a corporate buying frenzy with a lot of mergers, which wound up buying out its old corporate parent and then taking its name. Verizon, which was basically a merger of a lot of East Coast telephonies, 9X, Bell Atlantic, GTE, all under a single corporate umbrella that was renamed Verizon, as well as the last of the baby bells, so a much smaller one with less influence, but still there, Quest, mostly in the Pacific Northwest and Middle West, so Wyoming, Montana, Washington, Oregon, roughly there. But yeah, the same pattern there held. And even this is a dramatic instance of where antitrust was long thought of as a big solution to this. And it got successfully applied. But the solution you would think would, where market, fans of market policy may say, look, we did this and now things are gonna be better, watch. But what they don't account for and seldom and often ignore is that markets tend to consolidate. And that's actually what wound up happening here. And to the point where now, at least as far as telephony, and it's going to be just more than telephony because that's going to be, my cell phone, that's going to be the range of media that are going to serve as the basis of the internet, and that digital transition is going to be the basis of practically all our media, because all of our media are going to be transmitted in a lot of the way there now through digital means. That consolidation proves to be immensely important, as well as the policies to help to shape that. So that's why people have been fighting for things like, for example, network neutrality, policy that says internet service providers can't discriminate content. And there's been some success. In fact, the FCC passed a law, a policy of net neutrality a couple years back, but which has been criticized, rightly so, I think, as kind of watered down and full of loopholes. But nonetheless, this could be the basis for hopefully better policy. At least you got a law. Hopefully you can make it better. Going back to radio here for a moment, we see this kind of influence here with regards to media and the reason why I wanted to go through all this history. Because it's the same pattern that more or less applies regardless to media, with the lone exception being the American Revolution for reasons I had explained. The thing about all of this is that very little, since all of this is done basically in a very corrupt fashion behind closed doors with little public knowledge or involvement, the result winds up being very corrupt. That is both a bad thing, but also a very good thing in that that actually empowers people who know about this and can talk about it to spread the word about that. And as a result, help to change that policy because more people know about it and get involved in it. And that's what actually winds up being a very fruitful policy. I've been involved myself personally in political activism on media issues going back 10 years. And it both astonishes me that a lot of activists, never mind like the John Q. Public out there, but a lot of political activists are very, I hate to say it, ignorant of a lot of this policy and a lot of this work and a lot of the history about this. People have been trying to fight these fights going back hundreds of years. Some success, a lot of failure, but nonetheless, they've been there. And it just isn't the fact that this stuff happens and you just roll over. A lot of times, a lot of these fights, especially with regards to radio, even if a little few things had happened and more people had gotten involved, we could have won a lot of these fights, or certainly a lot more of these fights with regards to a lot of these media. And so that's why knowledge about this and involvement, even little involvement, can prove to be a very potent and powerful salutary effect and can change the policy and media that wind up resulting as a result. Like another quick example, satellite television. Activists in the 1980s wound up pushing for having a small portion of satellite television spectrum set up for non-profit, non-commercial use. 4% of that spectrum. They wound up pushing and fighting, and they actually won that. And that wound up actually being, you might think, oh, that's, that we lost 96%, but at least you got 4%, and actually set up the basis for channels like, for example, Link TV and Free Speech TV on satellite. These are 24-hour-a-day national television satellite, which if anyone who has DirecTV or Dish Network, and that's like tens of millions of people nationwide, they get these channels. They can see them. They find them. I helped to produce a TV show that is carried on both DirecTV and Dish Network. And believe me, we get phone calls from people from all across the country. I'll go to like the National Conference for Media Reform, and I'll end up with like random people from like Omaha who will see me, recognize me, because they saw me on this TV, because they get the channel, because the channel was around, because the policy fight to make that channel happen with hardly anyone involved except a relatively small people working immensely hard despite huge odds were able to fight for that. And as a result, I get recognized at a conference 15 years later. But that is what is so encouraging about this, that even the relatively small efforts and the knowledge about this and spreading that word about this can be a very potent salutary effect and is the thing that the major corporate media are humongously deathly afraid of. They do not want to talk about this. They don't want things like this to happen. They think that six people in a single room is just too fucking much for them. But nonetheless, I've seen that time and again where even small groups, when in the right place at the right time and the right involvement, can make a big difference. And that's what I'm gonna talk with you about today. So if you, here. Everyone has a copy of this handout?
Yeah.
Okay, this is where the rubber hits the road. You want, like, looking for specific things to do on this front, especially with regards going back to Rush Limbaugh on this front. There are two major actions that can be carried out with regards to policy, at least with regards to broadcast, radio and television. The windows open once every 8 years. The window in meaning that various actions can be taken that can't be taken otherwise. For in the case of Illinois, that window for radio is going to open this year, specifically in November, which means that you have the chance now and in the coming months to carry out actions that can help to shape that policy to improve things down the road. One, there are two in particular, one of which is immensely hard and practically impossible to win, the other of which is much easier and can lead to very surprising, unexpected consequences, and which what I'm going to talk about at some great length. The first one is what's referred to as a petition to deny, which is a formal request to the FCC to a specific radio station, where you're actually asking the FCC to deny the license renewal of a station for one or another public interest ground. That sounds great. In theory, it is a fantastic idea. In practice, it almost never happens. And by almost, I'm talking like 4 out of like 100,000 renewals over the course of 70 years. It is immensely hard. It rarely happens. And in fact, in the FCC's history, the only times they've ever done it were when they were actually compelled by an outside court to do so. They have never done it on their own accord. And for good reason, because it turns out that the quick history on the FCC policy is a lot of the FCC staff, commissioners and high-ranking staff, actually wind up leaving the FCC to work for the major corporate media that they were supposedly regulating while at the FCC. So they don't want to anger their future bosses as a result. So that winds up being even more of a corrupt situation, but one which at least can, you don't win in these fights through the FCC. In fact, that's where a lot of these fights go to die. But you can use the FCC as a kind of leverage point to win fights by other means. And that's what I'm talking about here with regards to informal objections. So there's a petition to deny, which is basically says that you're asking the FCC to file a petition. You have to, it's incredibly detailed, immensely hard. You have to have a lawyer, you have to have an affidavit, you have to have a specific complaint, and you have to have a lot of patience. I'm the party in interest to a petition to deny for 9 Chicago area TV stations that was actually filed 7 years ago. The petition has been rejected by the FCC 4 times since. It is actually right now in its 5th appeal. And that petition is actually before the full commission now. Maybe in a year or so they'll finally reject it finally. At which point then what we may well do is probably file it to an outside court in the hopes that maybe they'll win it. And then maybe if they not, then maybe an appeal to the Supreme Court. But we're talking years down the road if that were to happen. But, and it's for this reason that I actually don't recommend pursuing that kind of petition to deny. It's a lot of it is a dead end, and the system itself is set up in a way that trying to pursue that is basically blocked off. But there are ways to win reforms and significant ones by other means, and one of which I'm talking about here is what's referred to as an informal objection. This is actually very easy to do. In fact, if you look at the bottom, there are two URLs that I've set up. They're very long, so I actually set them up through tinyurl.com. One, which is the FCC's own page on informal objections, which I actually included some verbiage of here, which basically tells you what it is. It basically could amount to a rant. You've got a rant against WLS. They're broadcasting Rush Limbaugh. Rush Limbaugh is a sexist douchebag. I hate him. His guts, he should be fired. WLS should have their station, have their license revoked because of this. You can write a rant in the course of maybe as a three-page letter, specifically pointing to WLS and saying, I object to this. And this is how you would do it. You follow the instructions here. You have to write this up as a letter, and you have to send it into the FCC before November 1st. There's a deadline here, so you've got to do that. What that would look like, I've actually got as a sample informal objection. A friend of mine, Steve Masek, who is on the faculty at North Central College in Naperville, wrote an informal objection against WGN-TV. And he wrote it as a kind of very nice, structured, very well-argued letter, maybe 4 pages long. And so if you want to know what it looks like to write an informal objection, here's an example. Go to the website, type this in, tinyurl.com/sample-informal-objection. It'll bring up a copy of Steve's letter that he wrote to the FCC against WGN-TV. So if you want to know what it looks like to file an informal objection and what one would look like, there you go. Write up a letter, make it a rant, argue it as well and as passionately as you can. Submit it in using these instructions. And also tell others that you filed this, share what you wrote, and encourage them to do the same. Because if a lot of stations have a lot of informal objections, here's the thing about it. It actually won't formally challenge the license, but it will certainly make their lawyers very busy for a long time. And especially where these days, where a lot of radio stations have a lot of pullback and a lot of things, if they are kind of stretched too thin, there might be opportunities there to try to wedge in, or some dramatic thing may happen that actually might have an effect here. You never know where a lot of these actions would go. In fact, it was actually another very encouraging fact actually related to all of this. Upwards of 3 million objections, both formal and informal, were filed before the FCC in 2002 and in 2003, when the FCC was trying to basically scrap the remaining media ownership rules. And this was a dramatic fight that wound up crystallizing probably the most inspiring media activism effort in a generation. And it happened maybe, we're now approaching the 10th anniversary of it. And it was actually encouraging in a lot of ways. Not only did a lot of people enter the fray on this, in numbers unparalleled, but also it wound up doing what very few issues can do, merge both left and right on a single issue. You saw people, for example, the National Rifle Association and a lot of conservative groups who were also concerned with regards to media concentration and the ill effects it had, who were also, oddly enough, filing their own complaints, telling people about this, encouraging people to get involved. And what wound up being a very peculiar tactical coalition with, activist groups like Chicago Media Action I'm involved with, or with Free Press, a national group, or with the National Organization for Women, which was also involved, or with Common Cause, another national umbrella group of a lot of activism or efforts. So suddenly you saw all these people working on in multiple fronts for the same effort. The FCC blew them off. Congress did not, nor did the court that actually reversed the FCC order. In fact, they actually directly acknowledged the court in Philadelphia that actually overturned the FCC action on this front back in 2003 and actually overturned it a second time 4 years later. And a third time 4 years after that, they said a million people, actually more like 3 million people, but in their words, a million people filed objections about this. Doesn't that matter? In the court's estimation, they thought it did. And that's why they actually granted a stay against that, which bought time for a lawsuit which actually overturned that law. Had that passed, the law, the media now would be, you complain about it now, believe me, it would have been light years worse had that happened. But that's where informal objections that might seem like you're just blowing off steam and it's not having an impact, it can and it will in ways you can't anticipate. So that's why I'm encouraging you to get involved. Your instructions are here. There's a sample copy here. That completes my rant. Thank you for listening. If you have questions or concerns, now's the time. Yes?
Yeah, Mitchell, could you say something about access television and also about broadband and why, and then low power FM?
Yeah.
Those three things.
Absolutely. Beverly is a friend of mine, and she is raising concerns with regards to a lot of this kind of alternative media efforts that have been building and that are still around. And then also were the result of policy fights that were actually able to kind of crystallize a lot of positive media developments. One was efforts with regards in the early 1980s to carve out a small portion of cable television spectrum for public access television channels. In Chicago, we're very lucky that we have CAN-TV, a very good service network. It actually runs 5 channels. And a lot of political activists make use of it, and a lot of people see it. It's 600,000 households in the Chicago city limits. A lot of people see it, a lot of people find out about it, and it's a great way for people to do that kind of outreach. But that happened, again, because of those, you know, nerdy, wonky technical policies that people were involved with back in the early 1980s when few people knew about it or cared, but who got involved, spread the word about that, were able to build up that mass, at least enough of an effort, that actually wound up winning a small portion of policy to win those channels. Unfortunately, we've seen fights from the corporate media that have been trying to overturn that with, unfortunately, some success. The most recent one was an effort within the last 5 years or so to remove a kind of local franchise authority that had been within the authority of maybe... cable channels are distributed out via local authority, usually a city, sometimes a town, sometimes even a neighborhood. What wound up happening was in corporations, usually AT&T and a little extent Comcast, wound up pushing for, and in a lot of states winning, statewide franchises. So the authority there would actually be at the level of a state, usually at the state capital of the state, rather than in the various community. That matters because that authority, local authority also sometimes means a lot of local funding for these things. Remove that authority, a lot of times you remove the funding for that and those public access stations dry up. And unfortunately, we've seen that more than 100 times in the last few years. There actually was a study convened last year by the Benton Foundation that actually looked at what damage has been done in the wake of all these channels and the changes that resulted as a result of this. Where these policies were set up as a way to kind of, you know, foment competition, they actually wound up didn't really do that, but it had a great effect to actually demolish public access channels. And so now a lot of fight has been in place to try to preserve the channels that we have in the hopes of trying to expand things a little bit more. Broadband is another encouraging development, the ability of communities to be able to try to control their internet access. And this was also a pretty heady fight in the mid-2000s, where you had corporations trying to remove the authority from local communities as far as them being able to set up their own locally responsive broadband internet connections, corporations tried to pass laws that basically made that illegal. And then you had a pushback that actually resulted in the last couple of years in some states actually wounding with some success. Illinois was one of the states that actually had some success in that front in 2005 and in 2007. So it's a struggle that continues, but also increasingly so with the priority of broadband and where more and more people are seeing the internet as more of a kind of utility like electricity or water that everyone should and better have. The internet is kind of going in that kind of direction, and its importance there and the policies and trying to craft those policies to help to shape that are critical and have been going on and hopefully will still go on. Low power FM, kind of touching on the radio, is a kind of civil disobedience in terms of radio that goes. It's the idea of, at least for quite a long time, using radio equipment, which has increasingly dropped in cost and is increasingly technically feasible for a lot of people to be able to make and use. And just basically starting up your own radio station. Taking whatever vacant spectrum there is in a community, and a lot of times there's a lot of it there. And basically just starting up your own station. Mind you that unless you're licensed by the FCC, this is illegal to do. But a lot of communities, a lot of efforts did it anyway because they felt like it was worth it to try to do that just because local, there was no other locally responsive radio resource available otherwise. And so what you wound up happening is, and there's been, and there's actually been some research on this in the last like 15 years or so, efforts to try to crack down on this, to try to remove stations that were actually responsive community broadcasters and removing their equipment because they were engaging in an ostensibly illegal act. The thing though is that the technology of this is so easy to buy and relatively easy to reproduce that the FCC actually wound up quickly getting outstripped in their efforts to try to enforce this. And so there were efforts about thinking by community radio lobbyists to say, well, why don't you just license this? You license this for big radio stations, why don't you do it for little ones? And so the FCC actually ultimately did pass a law in 2000 to license a low power FM radio broadcast spectrum, which actually succeeded to some extent, but failed to another extent because that law actually wound up getting watered down by corporate media lobbyists in the dead of night to reduce the number of potential low power FM radio stations in big cities. And that effort, and so it's been a serious struggle since then to try to restore those lost radio stations, which actually succeeded just a year and a half ago. It was in 2010 that an effort called the Local Community Radio Act actually succeeded and actually passed into law. They were actually able to defeat the major corporate radio lobbies on that front. And now they have, and probably sometime early next year, we'll probably start seeing the allotment of local radio stations in cities across the United States, in big cities across the United States. We've been seeing some in local communities that have been going on now for almost 10 years now. And obviously, it's a mixed bag, but there are some that have proven to be responsive and very helpful and very useful as far as resources go. So yeah, that's another wedge in this whole media apparatus that the corporate media have been fighting tooth and nail against, precisely because they know that it's they see that as a challenge that they want to prevent from fomenting because they feel like that they that would raise the taste of a lot of people in their communities. And who would then demand, well, hey, you've got this local community radio station is putting on quality content. Why isn't WLS putting on quality content rather than Rush Limbaugh all goddamn time? So that's why they've been fighting this. They've been losing the policy fights precisely because relatively small but very active communities of a grassroots nature have been fighting for this and have now succeeded. And hopefully now we'll be able to see the fruits in the coming years of where this goes. Yeah.
One person didn't mention that. I don't know too much about this story. It was another guy named Glenn Beck.
Mm-hmm.
They had, the way they got rid of him is they went through the advertisers, as far as I know. So is that a good, you have any information on, because these radio stations, you can tell them, well, we don't have to pull your whole license, but we'd appreciate it if you drop
right
one or two objectionable programs like Rush Limbaugh, who's a sexist and racist and everything.
Right.
And if you could do that, like, and tell their advertisers, or like, we're going to boycott you unless you drop that, you know, supporting Rush Limbaugh. That seemed to work for this Glenn Beck guy, so then I was wondering, got information on that?
Yeah.
Because that seemed to work one, at least one time.
Yes. Glenn Beck, since he had been, Glenn Beck actually also started in radio. He was actually...
He's on radio and TV, I think.
Yes, but he started in radio.
Oh, okay.
The first time I heard of him was actually when the Clear Channel broadcaster in Midwest head of Clear Channel in Chicago spoke at Northwestern University Law School at the Midwest Forum on Media Ownership. And he touted a guy out of Cincinnati who was a really great example of someone who was locally responsive to their community, a guy named Glenn Beck, who was organizing these pro-war rallies around the time of the start of the war in Iraq. You saw these... You sometimes hear stories about these people who, you know, these weird, unwashed activists who have weird ideas about the war and want to object to the war, but nonetheless couldn't get, you know, were holding their own rallies and maybe they got it on TV once or twice. And there was a guy who was like, felt like, where's the pro-war side of these things? And there's one guy out of Cincinnati named Glenn Beck started organizing pro-war rallies. And that's actually how he came, that's how it came to my attention. He was actually started as a radio broadcaster. Then wound up getting a lot more attention as a result of this. Wound up then getting picked up by CNN on Headline News as one of their late evening commentators. And basically bringing a refreshing right-wing voice to, you know, the balance of CNN. And at which point then he got the attention of Fox News. He became a staple on their show, filling up a relatively dead hour, but making it immensely successful. Very high ratings, lots of people, but also saying a lot of off-the-wall things. And that's why you saw efforts like, for example, Color of Change, communities of color involved in a political activist campaign who said, okay, this guy's got to go. How do we get him off? Well, one way is let's get their advertisers to deem him toxic so they won't want to advertise. And they kept up a campaign over the course of 18 months to do that. And very successful. They actually wound up getting, I think the number ultimately was upwards of like 240 companies to pull their advertising, if not off of Fox entirely, at least off of Glenn Beck. And that wound up playing a significant role. The exact details I don't think have been made public, but yeah, Fox ultimately dumped Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck also wound up establishing his own radio presence privately, so that you can actually subscribe to glennbeck.com and you can get your dose of Glenn Beck-itude that way. But the fact is, you have to subscribe to that. It's not on Fox News anymore. So that's a great thing. And the reason, one big reason it looks like, is because of a lot of pressure over a long time to a lot of advertisers saying, look, you sell your product to communities of color. Communities of color don't like what Glenn Beck is saying, and they made this clear. Why are you supporting this, especially to your customer base? So yeah, that's been one thing about this. That is actually a technique that has been also used with regards to Rush Limbaugh. To some success, in fact. Just last week, Cumulus Media, which is the distributor of Rush Limbaugh, announced that they actually lost money last quarter. A little bit with regards to, I mean, it's hundreds of million dollars of profit that it produced. But they did notice a little bit of profit downturn. That matters for advertisers, because even a little profit downturn is like old cheese to advertisers. They don't want it. They are scared to death even of where it occurs even a little bit. And so it actually has been proven to be a little bit of an effect to the point where there has been talk, although I don't think it's actually materialized yet, that Cumulus may ultimately dump Rush Limbaugh entirely, precisely because of not only this flack and this and protests like that outside WLS that you're seeing now twice a week on Mondays and Thursdays from 4 to 6, but also the fact that advertisers are now, at least for the moment, pulling back. Whether or not they stay off is another question. It's entirely possible that they may stay off for a little bit until the controversy may die down a little bit, and then they may just jump back on after a controversy passes. That may not necessarily be successful. Don Imus, for example. I mean, one guy who, you would listen to him for years and he would say the most outrageous things. But yet he said a comment where it was pretty outrageous, but he pushed the wrong button at the wrong time. His infamous comment with regards to the Rutgers University women's basketball team of 2007, who played in the NCAA women's championship game, wound up actually losing that game. But he watched that game. It was broadcast on ESPN. Lots of people were watching it. And he was. And he regarded them as nappy-headed hoes. And oh boy, did the stuff hit the fan. To the extent that within 8 days, the guy lost his job. Because of controversy, of protest, of a lot of advertiser pullback. In fact, it wasn't even really advertiser pullback. It was the threat of 9 advertisers saying, you got to do something or we'll pull out. Gone within a week. Rush Limbaugh has been a lot more established and he's a lot harder to wedge out. But yeah, you got to be involved in activism on these issues because you never know where it's going to go. And it can go materialize in positive directions in ways none of us can foresee. But and which I've seen time and again. Someday maybe I'll write a book about, you know, unexpected stories of small, seemingly insignificant media actions that wind up having huge effects later on. I've lived that life for the last decade, and I've seen that story time and again. And this is yet another example about that. And anything to try to encourage that, actions that you think might not be that might be insignificant or that might be just a waste of time can prove that we have a great significance. And you might find this useful. Yeah. So yeah, keep hope alive.
Okay. Anyone else?
Any other questions?
Yeah. Why don't you say something about the internet?
There's a lot to say about the internet. The internet is going to be, to a great extent already is, the medium of the future. It is going to be the bedrock on which all future technologies are going to go. Television's already gone that way, but the digital high-powered television transition that occurred 3 years ago. Radio is more of a mixed bag, mainly because the ability to try to digitize radio, and I'm not talking about like a digital radio receiver, which was able to take streams and distribute them via the internet, but actually taking the radio spectrum, digitizing that, and then spreading that onto digital capable receivers. Different ball game there. That's proven to be very hard, mainly because the quality of it, as far as listening to it, isn't all that much better. And it's very hard to try to get people to try to buy this. You're finding this actually also in Europe as well, but increasingly so as well in the United States. When you try to sell, you know, digital capable radio receivers, nobody buys them. And so it's been very hard to try to do this. But certainly the web, certainly a lot of telephony, certainly, you know, social media, all that rides on a radio, on an internet backbone. And so policies with regards to the internet, things like network neutrality, of non-interference of internet content, things like the kind of privacy fights we've seen in the last 6 months with regards to the SOPA and PIPA fights, legislation that basically allowed websites and resources to be taken down because of potential copyright infringements, or the most recent warping of this, a new attempt called CISPA, C-I-S-P-A, whose initials I can't remember, but if you look it up, you can find gobs of information about it, which actually already passed the House of Representatives, but it's going to have a tougher fight in the Senate. That is kind of a watered-down version where it actually puts the burden of assessing copyright violations not on copyright holders, but on the government. And so a lot of players who had been against SOPA and PIPA are saying, okay, at least we don't have to do the work about figuring this out. The government will do it. So yeah, that's fine. That's less work for us. That's cool. We won't oppose this legislation. But yet that same problem there could prove to be at play, especially where it's very vague and very subjective as far as where that goes. So it's that kind of, that fight there, especially where it won't be just the kind of media that we have now, but media that even haven't yet been imagined yet, that are going to prove to be critical as far as where things go and where our media system in a lot of ways takes us. The policy fights for that are being fought now. And so knowing about this and getting involved with them, even in seemingly insignificant ways, can have a very huge impact. In fact, with the SOPA PIPA fight, that materialized, I actually saw it happen. A website, some people may know it, but a lot of people don't, Reddit, reddit.com. Like you read it, but it's spelled Reddit, reddit.com. A very active website for a lot of discussions and a lot of topics. And so they were following SOPA and PIPA because it would affect Reddit, potentially. And so a lot of these folks were saying, there's this legislation that's kind of got a head of steam and might pass and it might be bad for us. Shouldn't we try to stop this? And so they actually organized for Reddit alone a blackout website. The idea being that for one day, January 18th, they actually figured out the date themselves. We're going to go black. Everything's going black on our website. And we're going to highlight this law that you should learn about and you should tell people about. And so that Reddit being reasonably influential got ties to a lot of other websites. That encouraged a lot of other websites to kind of follow along. Upwards of 7,000 websites also did their part as far as contributing into this kind of coordinated blackout. Two most particularly, one, Wikipedia, which is being like, I think it's like the seventh most popular website in the world, also had a blackout. For one day, they went offline completely. And so, yeah, everyone who was expecting to use Wikipedia for their homework on January 18th, like, oh my God, the government's gonna kill Wikipedia. We have to stop them. Google also had a similar action in a very dramatic, where they usually have what's called a Google Doodle, where they'll sometimes replace their Google logo with some clever design because it's, whatever, Frank Lloyd Wright's birthday or something like that. They actually blocked out their entire logo for one day. And they're just like, that's interesting. Why is that? And you could click on the link and find out about SOPA and PIPA and why Google is opposing that and why you should too. And Google being, I think it's fallen to the second most popular website on the internet. Nonetheless, it's still popular enough that it drew a lot of people to it and a lot of discussion, attention, and SOPA and PIPA were formally shelved. Now, that's not to say that there are efforts to try to do effectively the same thing. CISPA, the current instance of that, already passed the House, might fail in the Senate. There are actually some pretty hopeful signs. We'll see about that, but that's where this is going. And the fact that we've been able to fight these fights, and I can give much longer stories regarding internet and media policy going back, and luckily we're in that point now where those policy fights have made a difference. I mean, I can give you an entire lecture on the 2006 net neutrality fight, which was fought in Chicago, actually wound up being an epicenter of that. The National Day of Outrage started right here. Actually, it was a meeting of, you know, these folks, Ron, myself, and who's the third person? There's like a third person who was involved in the meeting. Not Jeanette. Shoot, I forgot her name. There were three of us at the meeting. We decided on May 24, 2006 to stage a protest. I sent out an email to three mailing lists. Suddenly, seven other cities are organizing protests. It got on Democracy Now! In three consecutive days as a headline. It actually got into the corporate media business press as a result of all of this stuff. And it didn't stop what was then the COPE Act, the main anti-net neutrality legislation, from passing the House. But it actually helped to foment a lot more activity that wound up killing it in the Senate, even though it actually passed out of committee. Ted Stevens, the infamous series of tubes remark, you might remember this. Hi, doggy. That actually wound up materializing as a result of a lot of this activism that two people took out. But we're fighting that fight now. And even small, seemingly insignificant actions can have huge consequences. If we had lost that fight, mainly because we never fought against it to begin with, then you know, the internet now, 6 years later, might be a very different and probably less participatory place. So, yeah, getting involved in these efforts is a thing to do.
Yeah, Mitchell, could I just call attention to everybody?
Yeah. Beverly.
There are three groups in the Chicago area that have joined to put together a really terrific workshop, and that's June the 2nd. It's called Myths, Democracy, and Tools for Media Literacy Education. It's particularly aimed at teachers because media is crucial to having a democracy.
Sure.
And I have one of those.
Okay, sure.
Thank you. And it's not really being taught in our curriculum in schools. And so what we want to do is encourage teachers to include media literacy education in their curriculum at school. If you're not a teacher, it's still important because we all benefit if we're, you know, if the public is more literate about media. And so encourage you to come, encourage you to pass the word, especially if you know teachers, to encourage them to come. One of our presenters is Scott Sanders, who is right here, but we'll also...
You know, I have a question.
Yeah, so urge you to come.
I just had, we were considering planning another session like this the next time they hold an event like this, and this would be something that I would probably end up organizing and facilitating, and I just wanted to know if there was interest. In one of the areas that Mitchell wasn't really able to talk on basically because of time is the fact that the right has such a massive media infrastructure, okay, and the left barely has one, and it's fragmented, and in the case of the NPR and PBS national networks, I'm talking about ubiquitous networks, not just something on your block in your neighborhood. these are extremely compromised and don't serve the public needs hardly ever. They're just slightly better than what else is out there. So we have a proposal that would help to create, bring together the PEG access, these LPFM stations that should come online next year, and other existing mass public and community networks, trying to bring them together and make it larger through direct action. Is that of interest to you?
I think, like I said, a lot of people don't even know what's what, because that's all they do is they listen to WLS, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so they just believe what they hear, so should have an alternative.
I'm literally talking about ubiquitous alternative community networks that would be very large, like hitting everyone, not just little groups.
That's what I'm saying, is that people don't know any better.
Would you be interested in that, sir?
I don't know what part I would have, and probably this would know. On what would be needed to do something like that.
Well, we'll run it by Occupy and see if they like the idea.
Well, like I said, education, you know, they had a teacher talking up there, and so this is part of, you got to have access to it. I mean, not everybody's going to get it in school like Beverly wants, but there's got to be somebody doing it. Mm-hmm. So just, I would try it like Mitch was, just try anything. You never know what's going
to
work.
That's what I think we all have to try and do. You've got all these different problems you have to work on.
How did Occupy Wall Street start?
Well, Occupy Wall Street, then you got this anti-NATO thing, then you've got the nurses.
But I mean, my point is Occupy Wall Street was an idea by a magazine that hardly anyone subscribed to, or most people hadn't heard of.
I don't have the history of it.
No, I used to subscribe to Adbusters. What?
It was Canadian.
Yeah, Adbusters is headquartered out of Vancouver.
Yep.
Yeah, I used to subscribe to it. I had friends who were there. They came up with the idea. They sent out an email back in July of last year.
Yeah.
Tactical briefing number, what was it, 27? Occupy Wall Street was their idea.
They suggested the date.
They actually announced September 17th.
And people in New York, activists in New York, picked up on this idea. And to me, it's like a volleyball game. You know, it's not just one person that gets the ball over the net. You know, I mean, it's all of us working together. And so we can't, no one person can, or even one group, can get the job done. Yeah, and that's why today is such a culmination, not the last culmination, but an important culmination in the networking that has been done. And I want to give a plug to Illinois Coalition for Justice, Peace, and the Environment, which was set up in 2006. It now has 180 activist member groups and organizations in Illinois. And it has facilitated the event that you're seeing now. I mean, a lot of other people have been involved, but it's that kind of networking, working together, that is going to be the only thing that can save us. And so I just can't urge everyone here enough to sign up. Do you have a sign-up sheet?
Yes, I should.
To sign up for the Chicago Media Action News listserv. It doesn't, Mitchell and Scott don't inundate you with lots of emails, but it is essential that we expand that network to all of our communities. No matter what community you live in, whether it's in Chicago or a suburb, we've got to stay connected, pass the word. Sometimes there are critical actions that CMA will suggest. It doesn't overdo it, you know, it doesn't wear you out. But there's a monthly newsletter that Scott and Mitchell do, keep you up on these important media issues. And one of the ways that the 1% maintains
control, only be here for 3 weeks, but
is that
it
mystifies us.
You can unsubscribe later if you want.
All these things are too complicated for the ordinary person to understand. You know, you have to be an expert like us to understand these issues. Well, that's all BS. because these issues can be broken down so that we, the people, understand what's going on. And then we can push back, like, you know, like Mitchell is saying. But as long as we think, oh, you know, they know it, and we don't, then we lose a sense of our own power.
It's having been involved with people in the corporate media and talking to them about policy, I can say offhand, a lot of the times we know a lot more than they do about these things. Even a lot of the lawyers I've talked to about this, who are still kind of talk about this on very narrow grounds, they're still pretty ignorant. If it came down to a game of knowledge, we'd have them beat, hands down. Unfortunately, it's more than just that. But you know, knowledge is part of the process of building power, so that's what this is about. So consider yourself slightly more empowered than when you came in.
I came in kind of late, so.
I've got the audio of this presentation if you'd like to hear it later on.
Okay.
Okay. Do you have a card or an email? I can give you my email if you'd like.
Yes, I can give you my email.
Okay. Tell you what, there's a sign-up sheet going around. If you can sign up on that,
okay.
And then just check out saying, send me the audio. We'll post this available online and I'll send you the link.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, okay.
All right, I'll stop.